Welcome back. We've got 25 minutes of open lines remaining here. Before we talk with Dr. Paul Meyer, we'll get a look at the resurrection of Jesus Christ in the last half hour of the second hour of Issues, Etc. In the third hour, Dr. Kim Riddlebarger joins us. He's from the White Horse Inn. We'll have part two of our four-part series on understanding the end times. I've been asking, what is your favorite Easter song? Getting a lot of responses, a lot of phone calls. So far, the one that has two callers, two votes, Because He Lives, I mistook that for a another hymn, Because He Lives. I have the actual words in front of me, and I'll read them here in just a minute. But I had said, I thought that it was one of the one hymn that says, you ask me how I know He lives, He lives within my heart. A line over which I think Christians ought to be choking, because if that's how we know He lives, then it's a rather subjective way of approaching the resurrection. Someone else could say, well, I know that Muhammad is alive because he lives within my heart, or any other person. We need something a little more objective than just living inside one's heart. Now, because he lives. And this just shows kind of my ignorance of a lot of the Easter songs. Because he lives, I can face tomorrow. Because he lives, all fear is gone. Because I know he holds the future and life is worth the living just because he lives. Now, one of the callers had voted for this one because she said it focused on his resurrection and not on his death. But a stanza one says, there was a man, his name was Jesus. He came to die, heal and restore. But greater still, the calm assurance we can face on certain days because he lives. But he did come to die. The death and the resurrection always go together. They always do. Every time Jesus appears, he makes reference after his resurrection. He makes reference to his death, either by showing them his hands and his side, or reminding his disciples on the road to Emmaus that he had to suffer these things. He's always pointing them back to the cross. I am alive, but I was dead. Those are almost exactly the same words that Jesus uses when he appears before John at the beginning of the book of Revelation. I am the living one. I was dead, and now I am alive forevermore. I hold the keys of death and hell. Death and resurrection go together. Now, we're giving away the latest recording of the Concordia Seminary Chorus's new CD called Jubilee to the best caller. Our phone numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. What's your favorite Easter song and why? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And now there may be some who are listening and say, wait a minute, it's after Easter. Why are you talking about this after Easter? Easter's over. It isn't. Easter is not over. Easter's not just a day, it's a season. Something that we quickly forget when all the Easter bunnies come down out of the stores. But a lot of Christians believe Easter is over when Easter's done. Easter's just the beginning of a season. It'll last a couple more weeks here. Willis is calling from Perryville. Willis, thank you for being patient and waiting. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Good afternoon, Todd. My vote is for I know that my Redeemer lives.
I know that my Redeemer lives. That's waiting for that one.
That's number 200 in our Lutheran hymnal, and it's also the words of Job, you know.
And why is it your favorite?
Well, it's the words of Job when he suffered, and it's used quite often for funeral songs, you know.
It is. In fact, Willis, thank you very much for the call. I was looking for this one in the hymnal, and I was looking in the Easter section of the hymnal, and I realized it's not in the Easter section of the hymnal. It's in, at least in the hymnal I got in front of me, it's in the funeral section, the death and burial section of the hymnal, and rightly so. My favorite stanza from this hymn. It's stanza 7 in the version I'm reading. He lives and grants me daily breath. And here is if there was ever a great line in a hymn, very simply put, not a lot of fol-de-rol, not a lot of hoop-de-doo, is the second line of this stanza. He lives and I shall conquer death. He lives my mansion to prepare. He lives to bring me safely there. Finally, a vote for I know that my Redeemer lives. I thought that would be first. Willis, thank you for the call. Mickey's calling from her car. Mickey, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hello, Todd.
Hi, Mickey.
My favorite Easter hymn is The Lamb.
Are you talking about the Lamb?
Yes, Gerald Coleman.
Yes.
Yes. that just tells the whole gospel.
Did you get a chance to sing it on Easter?
Yes. Yes, I did. And I love it every time we have it, and it's just the best.
Mickey, thank you for the call. I'm going to look this one up because that one should not pass unnoticed. The Lamb, I'll find it here in just a second as time goes by. Let's talk with Kent from his car in the meantime. Kent, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd. It's been a while.
It has been a while, Kent.
Now hey, you talk to your producer. I'm always left on terminal hold. anyway, it's a tie, I think, between Christ the Lord is risen today and Jesus Christ is risen today. Both Charles Wesley versions set to the old 100th.
And why so?
They are wholly sound. Everything about them, while paraphrased, is soundly biblical about the resurrection that actually happened. No historical critical nonsense, no touchy-feely stuff.
You know, it really amazes me. What was the other one you mentioned?
Well, they're very similar, and they're set to the same old 100th. I think it's from an old Psalter. But it's Christ the Lord is risen today, and Jesus Christ is risen today. But I've got one to add also.
What's that?
That I heard for the first time this Sunday. It was set to an old Shaker hymn. I think it was called 4 3 Days or something. But as often as I do in church, I almost lost it. I was crying after like one line, thinking what Christ had done for me, has done for me. Now that said, you're going to say, oh, that's not right. You're a Catholic. You worship statues.
I didn't say that.
No, I don't. And I fall down on my knees and thank God that I'm neither ignorant nor unintelligent. And I've almost called and throttled people over these past few months. But there is nothing more biblical and more Christ-centered than the Mass. That's all I'm going to say about that.
Kent, thank you for the call. I agree. I mean, the Mass rightly observed, without any of the human additions, there, you're right. What could be more Christ-centered than Christ's presence in his body and blood among his people? I mean, that's as Christ-centered as you get here on earth, right? I think he's absolutely right. Now, he mentioned, too, that, again, I'm a little astonished that these didn't get mentioned up to this point. Christ the Lord is risen today, and Jesus Christ is risen today. I always get these two confused because they are almost identical hymns. I wonder if you're putting together a hymnal, whether you have to choose between one or the other of those because they are so very similar. Now, a previous caller mentioned the Lamb. And I'll just read a few of its lines. So if you're not familiar with it, you know what the caller was talking about. The Lamb, O Father, where's the sacrifice? Faith sees, believes, God will provide the Lamb of price. Worthy is the Lamb whose death makes me his own. The Lamb is reigning on his throne. Here are two good stanzas. He sighs, he dies, he takes my sin and wretchedness. He lives, forgives, he gives me his own righteousness. And then the fifth stanza, he rose, my heart with thanks now overflows, his song prolong, till every heart to him belong. That's the Lamb, one of our callers' favorite Easter songs. What about you? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Randy's calling from Warrenton. Randy, welcome to Issues Etc. Randy, are you there?
Hello?
Hey, Randy, what's up?
Hi, I vote for the Lamb.
You vote for the Lamb, too?
Yeah, just like the previous caller said, it covers it all. We didn't sing it this Easter, but I'm still singing it from two Easters ago.
And so it's your favorite, even though you didn't get to sing it on Sunday?
Right, yeah.
And what is the reason again?
Basically, like the other caller, it tells it all from Good Friday through Easter.
Randy, thank you for the call.
You're welcome.
I think it's a song that's sung all the time, but it is a good Easter song. It does because the last two stanzas deal with the resurrection. Of course, every good hymn ought to cover this in some form or another, shouldn't it? Every good song ought to, if it's going to be Christian, ought to at least make mention. I mean, at the very least, make mention of the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. I mean, it could talk about the Trinity, and that would be distinctively Christian. But you really don't have the whole story until you have that second person of the Trinity incarnate in human flesh. That's the great thing about the Lamb hymn. There are two votes for the Lamb so far. Jan is calling from St. Charles. Jan, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I like Awake My Heart with Gladness.
Awake My Heart with Gladness. That is number two vote for that. Cindy called earlier with Awake My Heart with Gladness. What about that hymn makes it your favorite Easter song?
It has all the attention on what Christ did, his dying, his resurrection, his triumph, you know, everything.
Jan, thanks for the call.
Okay.
Now, I'm not going to try and give complete totals here, but we do have two votes for the Lamb. I just read a few stanzas. Two for Awake My Heart with Gladness. And if I'm counting correctly, there are two for Because He Lives. And I think those are the only ones that have more than one vote. We've had a number of calls, 13, 14 calls here so far. Let's get another one in here. Kurt is calling from his car. Kurt, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Pastor. I am a Lutheran, and I was in a Lutheran church, which I will not mention. And there is the Lamb, and boy, there's a whole bunch of others that I really do like. However, in church, we had a what the pastor did was he did a thing on the screen, and he showed Jesus the whole him being whipped and the throne and the thorns being put on his head. And all that, and during that, he played a song by Bryan Adams, and the title is "Everything I Do for You."
Hmm.
And the words, every single stanza, every single word, I thought, well, what's he doing putting this up here? But every word in that song, it's unbelievable. It matched, you know, it actually matched the video.
You know what? I have to go back and look at the lyrics. Of that particular, I know what song you're talking about. It was sung recently on American Idol, if I'm not mistaken. My daughter's a big fan of the show. Thank you for the call. I'd have to go back and look at the lyrics. Now, I would wonder this. Apart from a visual presentation of Christ suffering on the cross, would that song have anything to say about Jesus Christ? I understand what the caller's saying. The caller's saying, when presented together, Bryan Adams' song, Everything I Do for You, it comes from Robin Hood, right? Was that the Mel Gibson, or who played Robin Hood? Mel Gibson? Yeah, the Mel Gibson film of about a decade ago. Bryan Adams made a huge hit out of it, Everything I Do for You. I'm not going to attempt a Bryan Adams, he's a good singer, I'm not going to attempt an imitation here. But apart from a visual presentation of the cross, would it be anything more than what Bryan Adams intended it to be when he originally wrote it and what it was scored for as part of the soundtrack of that movie? A love song. I'm assuming it was the Robin Hood character and the Maid Marian character, although I didn't see the movie. I did like the song, though. It's a good song. The question is, does it have anything to do with Christ and Him crucified unless you couple it with the visual imagery of Christ and Him crucified? In other words, when a congregation gets together and perhaps they might even try and sing this song together, I don't know if it can move beyond a solo performance, would you have to also be showing the film of Christ's crucifixion in order for the message to be clear? I mean, it kind of raises an interesting thought, and that is, what other songs could you take and completely absented from their original context, shoehorn into a Christian message if you could show them alongside a video presentation of Christ crucified? It's kind of a third category. Not appropriate for worship, not inappropriate for worship, but it has to have a visual element. I mean, here we are in the video age, the MTV age, where the message of the song is determined by the visuals that accompany it and not the words themselves. Have I said that correctly? That a message of the song would be determined by the what if, what's the difference? If a church played that song while showing key scenes from the movie Robin Hood, and then played the song again showing key scenes from the crucifixion of Christ, should the words of a song actually explicitly have that message? Or can you take them and use them this way? Something for a future open lines. 505-7850-1-800-730-2727. Andy's calling from Los Angeles, listening on the internet. Andy, thank you for calling. Thank you for waiting. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, thanks. I like Christ the Lord is Risen Today.
Christ the Lord is Risen Today, and you make that two votes for Christ the Lord is Risen Today. You go along with Kent, if I'm not mistaken, and the similar hymn, Jesus Christ is Risen Today. Andy, why is that your favorite Easter song?
Well, I haven't sung it in a while. I remember singing it when I was younger, and I not only liked the words, but when I was younger, I would be in a church, and we would sing it in parts. And I just realized that one of the things I like about that is that diversity of voices, diversity of parts, singing the one truth together. I don't know. I just kind of like that aspect.
Andy, thank you. And thank you for listening on the internet. Two for Christ the Lord is Risen Today. This is my count. I might be wrong. Two for Awake My Heart with Gladness. Two for the Lamb. Two for Because He Lives. Yeah, I'm right on that. Sally's calling from St. Louis. Sally, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Pastor Wilkin. I would vote for At the Lamb's High Feast We Sing. And the reason I like that hymn is because it's just so chock full. I mean, you've got Lord's Supper imagery. You've got the Old Testament where Jesus is the our priest, high priest, and then it talks about death being destroyed and, you know, being released from sin. And then you've got a doxological verse with the whole Trinity. So it's just like hits everything all in one compact song. So my husband said he'd vote for Christ Jesus Lay in Death Strong Band.
All right. Is that your husband in the background?
Yeah.
All right, Sally, thank you very much for the call. So we've got another vote for Christ Jesus Lay in Death Strong Bands. That was the first hymn that was mentioned during this hour of open lines. And then Sally herself, not her husband, Sally wants At the Lamb's High Feast We Sing, which is also been mentioned as well. So that's two votes there. So we got this about six-way running tie between Because He Lives, the Lamb, Christ Jesus Lay in Death Strong Bands, Awake My Heart, At the Lamb's High Feast, and Christ the Lord is Risen Today. Clara's calling from Baldwin. Clara, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hello. My favorite is I Know That My Redeemer Lives. To me, that just says it all. And our church, well, they didn't do it this year, but last year they'd have trumpets playing as they sang it, and it just gave me goosebumps.
Clara, thank you so much. Now, the Claras makes that, too. This now is a seven-way tie running between these. And sooner or later, one of these will probably emerge. We're going to try and play one and two, if we could. And I'll have to pick two, I imagine. One and two at the end of this hour of Issues, Etc. I'm going to leave it to my producer to time those out because I have no idea how long the recordings are. The best callers during this hour will receive a cassette or a CD of the latest from the Concordia Seminary Chorus called Jubilee. 505-7850-1-800-730-2727. Mark is calling from Lyle, Illinois. Mark, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you.
Hey, Mark, where is Lyle?
Near Naperville, DuPage County, west of Chicago.
Holy smokes. Are you listening on the internet?
Yes, I am.
All right. Mark, what's your favorite Easter song?
Jesus Christ is Risen Today.
Jesus Christ is Risen Today. Thank you very much. Why is that?
For two reasons. In both the first and second stanza, it goes right to the heart of why we celebrate Easter. In the first stanza, who did once upon the cross suffer to redeem our loss? And in the second stanza, who endured the cross and grave, sinners to redeem and save.
So the gospel message is loud and clear in this song for you.
Yes, it is. And the other reason, I can't think of any other hymn that, for me, the marriage of the text and melody carries such a note of triumph as in that one.
Mark, thank you for listening on the internet. Thank you for the call. That gives us an eight-way tie. Now, if you make Christ the Lord is Risen Today and Jesus Christ is Risen Today, these two very similar hymns, if you count them as one hymn, we really got four votes for that category in there and two for a bunch of others. And we will be playing the top one as we end this hour of Issues Etc. Open Lines. Let's see if we can get a few more calls in here before that. Natalie is calling from her car. Natalie, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you. My favorite Easter hymn is I Know That My Redeemer Lives.
All right. And why is that?
Well, the one sentence that's in there, what comfort this sweet sentence gives. And then most of the lines in the verses all start with he. So the focus is totally on the work that Jesus has done.
That is great. Natalie, thank you very much. I'm going to write Natalie's name down. I want to send Natalie a copy of that Jubilee CD. Natalie, if you would call us back, my producer will get your name and address, and we'll send you a copy of that. There is a well-articulated reason why that's a good Easter hymn. He lives who once was dead. That's the joy of Easter. Not just someone alive. I mean, heck, anyone can make the claim to be alive. He lives who once was dead. And why was he dead? He was dead as a consequence of our sin. The death is good news. The resurrection is also good news. They go together. Jean is calling from her car phone. Jean, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, I want to put another vote in for I Know That My Redeemer Lives.
All right.
And I'm hoping to hear it at the end of the hour.
Okay, and why is that? Why is it your favorite?
I guess it's like Clara when they play the trumpet. It's just so emotional, and I also like the what comfort this sweet sentence gives.
Thank you very much, Jean. You know, that gives I Know That My Redeemer Lives. The one that I thought would be the first call in, the one that I was amazed that we got into about 45 minutes of open lines without having it mentioned, that gives it four votes, and that is to the two of about six other hymns, including The Lamb, Christ Jesus Lay in Death Strong Bands, Awake My Heart. Let's see. What's the other one? At the Lamb's High Feast we sing, Christ the Lord is risen today, Jesus Christ is risen today. But emerging with four votes, we'll hear this one as we go into the bottom of the hour break. I Know That My Redeemer Lives. Oh, we'll hear it coming out of the bottom of the hour break as we talk with Dr. Paul Meyer about the resurrection. What a great way to transition between an hour of open lines and a conversation on the resurrection of Jesus Christ with Dr. Paul Meyer, author of our book of the month, our Issues Etc. book of the month for April, the very first Easter. I don't know which one is my favorite. Sometimes when it comes to Easter hymns, good solid Easter hymns, my favorite is the one that we happen to be singing at the moment. I could go through the lyrics of and the various stanzas of all these hymns, and I could try and sum up which one actually gets the message articulated the best. But I don't know if that's necessarily a fruitful exercise as well, because some of these don't qualify to be, in my opinion, for various reasons, I don't know if they qualify either as Easter hymns or as perhaps the best in an objective sense. I mean, everyone can have their favorite, and that's what I was asking for. But I also asked, why is it your favorite? The message of the resurrection, Paul tells us, is at the heart and center of the Christian faith. And that means what we sing about it and how we sing about it is very important. It means how we are confessing our faith. It means how we are, what it is we believe about Jesus Christ risen from the dead. The hymn that was chosen, I Know That My Redeemer Lives, comes right after this break. Stay with us.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Children love stories, especially stories that are true. The greatest story you can tell your children is found in the Issues Etc. book of the month for April, called The Very First Easter. In this book, Dr. Paul Meyer vividly retells the story of Jesus' betrayal, his passion, his trials, his crucifixion, and his resurrection. It's the Issues Etc. book of the month for April, The Very First Easter. You can order this book online at our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on The Very First Easter. You can also order the book by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or go to our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Terry Phillips. A conservative Washington magazine is reporting a stern letter to Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle from his bishop in South Dakota. Daschle professes to be Catholic, but the article reports Bishop Robert Carlson has told Daschle he should no longer call himself a Catholic. David Brody reports from Washington.
The letter was intended to be a private one, but somehow it was leaked to the press. Though no details of the letter are available, it is believed that Bishop Carlson made clear that Daschle's pro-abortion view is in direct conflict with the Catholic Church.
He's not a Catholic. I mean, he may be a Catholic in name only, but that's it.
Judy Brown with the American Life League says the bishop did the right thing.
And one of the things that bishops are called to do by their office is to help those who are in error to amend their ways. Yes, what he did was controversial, and yes, it should have been kept private, but what he did is something that I wish every bishop would do.
For thousands of Catholics around the country, this is the beginning of answered prayer.
When I heard the news, I literally was bouncing off the ceiling.
Tim Chichester is with the Catholic Family Association. Over a year ago, his group started to pray and fast for Daschle in particular.
We had one woman commit to 180 days of prayer and fasting for Daschle. 180 days. I think this is wonderful.
Chichester believes this is just the beginning and prays that one day soon Daschle will realize abortion is not what God wants. In the meantime, though, Daschle released a statement saying that he's been a Catholic all his life and he'll remain one. For Family News and Focus, I'm David Brody in Washington.
Bishop Carlson has published a statement saying he would never break off dialogue with anyone. It's reported the bishop has had discussions with Daschle regarding his pro-abortion views in the past and has urged the senator to reconsider. For Family News and Focus, I'm Terry Phillips.
Next time on the Bible study, we'll be in Deuteronomy chapter 13, which is about worshiping other gods. I guess that really doesn't apply to us since we don't have other gods in our culture, or do we? We'll talk about Deuteronomy 13 with Pastor Mark Hawkinson next time on The Bible Study. The Bible Study, heard weekday mornings at 10:05.
The Bible Study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
Is the death and resurrection of Christ historically reliable? Find out with the new children's book, The Very First Easter, published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. The Very First Easter is the Issues Etc. book of the month for April, 1-800-325-3040. You can find out more about this book on the internet, issuesetc.org, and click What's New? The Very First Easter by Dr. Paul Meyer, our Issues Etc. book of the month for April.
That's the favorite Easter song of Issues Etc. listeners. I know that my Redeemer lives. It comes from the 19th chapter of the book of Job. And I want to thank Willis and Clara and Natalie and Jean for voting for that among all the others who called in with your favorite Easter songs during that last hour and a half of open lines issues, etc. This is, I must comment on this before before we leave that behind. If you look at verse 25 of chapter 19 in the book of Job, who can deny that Christ is in every page, on every word of the Old Testament, even in a book as seemingly obscure and difficult to understand as the book of Job? There in verse 25, chapter 19, I know that my Redeemer lives, and that at the last he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been thus destroyed, yet in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall behold, and not another. How my heart faints within me. There's Christ, all over the Old and the New Testament, and the resurrection of Christ, already known by the saints of old. We're going to spend the remainder of this hour of Issues, etc., talking with Dr. Paul Meyer. We're going to get a historical look at the resurrection of Jesus Christ. He's author of our Issues, etc., book of the month for April, the very first Easter, and of several books, including one called In the Fullness of Time. He's professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo. Dr. Meyer, welcome back to Issues, etc.
Good to be with you again, Todd.
There are so many questions that pile in when it comes to the resurrection of Jesus Christ, but I think the first one probably has to do with the resurrection itself and what the biblical account records of the actual coming out of the tomb. If I'm not mistaken, Matthew is the only one who actually records an event of the resurrection. The others all pick up the story after it's taken place. Tell us about that.
Well, it's quite clear that Luke, of course, was derivative in the sense that he became a Christian only later on, and he learned, of course, the great good news from St. Paul. And then later, while Paul was in prison in Caesarea, he would come to Jerusalem and probably catch the entire saga, the whole wonderful history from the apostles and Mother Mary. That's where he got the information on the Nativity. So we wouldn't expect him really to have been an eyewitness. Not that Matthew was either, you recall, but Matthew was one of the 12 disciples, and so he would probably have more immediate detail from his comrades.
And the event of the resurrection takes place before the sun comes up. By the time the women arrive, it's already taken place. A few basic questions there. Why are the women going to the tomb?
They weren't able to finish the burial preparation because it was late in the afternoon on Friday when Jesus died, and the body has to be off the cross by sundown. That's the rule from Deuteronomy, you recall. And to the present day yet, when somebody dies in Israel, he's buried the same day, absolutely. And so after sundown, you've got the Sabbath coming on, and they can't work. So it was kind of a hasty burial preparation for which they then had planned to come later on the first day of the week and complete the job.
What are they going to do? The account says they're carrying oils and spices or something along those lines.
It's simply a case of them having not sufficiently, they didn't have any, of course, modern embalming methods in those days, but it was to finish the burial so that Jesus would have a perfectly clean body wrapped in a shroud and so on. And they were simply didn't have enough time on Friday night.
When they arrive, it says the stone, they're wondering about the stone and who will roll it away. Was this common practice to seal the mouth of a cave tomb with a stone?
Todd, you can see them in the Holy Land of the present day yet. I know of at least 7 or 8 rolling stone tombs in the Judean area around Jerusalem, and there's even one up near the plain of Jezreel in Galilee, just exactly like you might picture it in the Easter accounts. They're not as big as you sometimes see that a person can simply walk in, you know, 5-6 foot person walk straight ahead. You'd have to crouch down somewhat. The stones themselves were about 3-4 feet in diameter. And there certainly would be heavy enough, and that's why the women are worried about who's going to be able to roll that stone away.
Now, this stone is not only itself a barrier to anyone trying to get in to the body, but it says it also has a seal on it. What was that about?
The Roman seal, remember the people went to Pilate, asked for permission to have the tomb sealed. This was not hermetically sealed. It's not a case of, an epoxy cement joint of any kind. It's the kind of seal that you find on your electric meter, so your water meter back home, which is a little aluminum thread, you recall, or very thin wire, which has a seal on it, and it will show if there's any tampering. If you cut it, for example, to try to adjust the meter, immediately they know it's been tampered with. So it's not intended physically to keep people out. It's rather a symbol that the tomb has been untouched or has been touched.
And what are they trying to guard against, or who is trying to guard against tampering, and why?
Grave robbery is what they're looking for here. You recall that the Jewish authorities came to Pilate on Saturday morning, and they say that this person had claimed to rise from the dead, and what if his disciples come along and steal the body? Then the second error will be worse than the first. And so Pilate at this point says, you already have a guard, you'll make the tomb as secure as you'd like. And so the whole idea was to ward against grave robbery. And by the way, Todd, there's an archaeological discovery about 1930 was found up in Nazareth, of all places, which warns, it's a Roman warning against grave theft. And the penalty for grave robbery was death, which was very unusual because the violation of sepulture, that's the official legal name in the Roman world, was much less stringent elsewhere. So one wonders why they were so insistent that the death penalty attend that. And it really looks very much like the originating news about the resurrection hit Rome. Rome, of course, couldn't believe in a resurrection. And so they assumed the body was stolen. And now, look, there's a whole cult beginning in worshiping of a person who supposedly rose from the dead. And to keep this kind of thing from happening, I think we have this grave robbery ordinance.
So in order to keep, religious sects from springing up every time a grave is robbed?
Well, it didn't happen that often, but yeah. Certainly in this case, to claim a resurrection shows that obviously they want to cut off this possible thing at the source.
Do we have an accurate location for the tomb of Jesus Christ?
On a 1 to 10 scale, probably we have an 8, I would say, which is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. To most modern pilgrims, of course, is a disappointment because it is under the same roof as the Golgotha area. And immediately they suspect that because they think that a person who was as wealthy as Joseph of Arimathea would not have had a tomb so nearby, a place of public execution. And yet the Gospel of John tells us there was in the place where he was crucified a new tomb that hadn't been used yet, in the place where he was crucified. And this whole area used to be just outside the western city gate of Jerusalem on the Joppa Road, or Jaffa, as it's called today. And so now, obviously, Jerusalem has been destroyed and rebuilt 13 times since Jesus' day, so that you're going to now have this site right smack in the middle of town rather than at the edge.
And really, how far apart are the likely location of the crucifixion, Golgotha, and the likely location of the garden tomb?
You walk into the Church of the Holy Sepulchre today, you turn right and go up a flight of steps, and you come to the Chapel of Calvary, and there you can see the white limestone of Golgotha through windows, you know, on the way up, and it's quite an impressive rise, as a matter of fact, and it is kind of skull-shaped. Then the resurrection tomb, you go back downstairs and then walk to the northwest about 50 yards or so, and there you come to the great big rotunda in the center of which they have a what's called an edicule, which represents where that tomb was originally. Unfortunately, if they'd only left the area alone, it would be so much more attractive. But what happened was this. When the Emperor Constantine first put up the Church of the Holy Sepulchre at the urging of his dear Christian mother, Helena, they cut the tomb away from its original escarpment and then surrounded it with a rotunda. And then later that was added to the Chapel of Calvary, and the whole thing today then was rebuilt by the Crusaders. However, early in the 1000 AD period, a mad Sultan Hakim from Egypt came along and tore everything down, even with the ground. And so that was the last of Joseph's tomb about 1,000 years ago. So all we can show you today is the most probable point in terms of longitude and latitude as to where that tomb was.
The tomb itself, the sepulcher, no longer exists if it was on the spot.
No, that's right.
All right. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Waiting on the line, Herman is calling from Illinois. Herman with a question. Welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you for taking my call. I would like to ask Dr. Meyer if he could give some explanatory detail to these grave clothes that Jesus was wrapped in. It would be my understanding that they were like wrapped bandings. It wasn't just a sheet or a shroud laid over him flat, but he was wrapped from head to foot, so to speak. And when in John 20, the two disciples, Peter and the other one, come into the open tomb, they see the head piece separate from the other piece, and it looks, I would take it to mean that those wrappings are still wrapped as if they're around the body, but the body's not in them.
That's probably a correct assumption. The fact is, the burial was not complete on Friday night, and so our big problem is how much of it was finished and how much of it wasn't. Now, those who are very enthusiastic about the Shroud of Turin, for example, will point out this is kind of a U-shaped, single wrapping of a linen sheet that was temporarily covering Jesus before those lateral bands would have been wrapped around him, very much like Lazarus had, for example. And if this is true, well, that would be one possible item in its favor. However, I personally do not credit the Shroud of Turin.
Now, this the grave clothes, the fact that that it's kind of an incomplete burial, I think you said.
Yes.
Why is it, do you think, that all the gospel writers who make mention of what's in the tomb make mention of this, that this is so significant?
I think it is. There's a very fascinating aspect of the Easter account which is overlooked, and I think that's the empty tomb. Now, to be sure, you don't find much reference to the empty tomb in the early church proclamation of the good news, and that's obvious why. But the great news is Jesus is risen from the dead. The empty tomb's kind of an afterthought. It's kind of the ripped open envelope without the letter. It's the rind of the resurrection, something you throw away. So who's interested in it? But as an ancient historian, I'm very fascinated by the empty tomb phenomenon. As a matter of fact, that's how I get into the resurrection when I'm trying to figure out whether this could have happened or not. And the empty tomb is something that we can indeed prove by using extra-biblical materials. And this is very often overlooked, and I think it's terribly important evidence. Now, the empty tomb does not prove the resurrection. Let's understand that. If you turn it the other way around, however, it does. You can't have a resurrection, at least a decent one, without the tomb being empty as its first symptom.
Okay, so if you mentioned extra-biblical accounts or evidence that would lend at least an empty tomb, not the resurrection, but at least to an empty tomb in Christ's case. Could you give us a summary?
Well, there's an interesting document in the Jewish rabbinic traditions called the Toledot Yeshu, which talks about the grave being opened and Jesus' body stolen. And you recall that accords perfectly with the gospel records. In Matthew, for example, the guards are told, if anybody asks you, claim that you were sleeping. And that the stolen body theory was one of the earliest natural explanations for the resurrection. So this is now conceded by Jewish sources. When it would have been in their interest to shut up about it, or perhaps unethically to lie about it, they concede that the tomb was empty. So when you have that kind of positive testimony in the context of a hostile source, that then becomes self-authenticating. It's called an admission against interest in the court of law. It's called, for New Testament scholars, the criterion of embarrassment. It's when you have to concede something. It doesn't particularly help your cause, but you got to admit it because everybody knows it's true. And if you denied it, that would undermine your whole credibility.
So there is a hostile source from around the time that admits, at the very least, the tomb had no one in it.
That's right. And then you supplement that with the fact that over 20 centuries since then, I have never, ever found any source, friendly or hostile, that says that the tomb never was empty, that there was still a body inside, which I think is remarkable. I would have thought that somebody would use that or try to fill that, you know, by lying or something like that. But there never has been a source that I know of. Now, I could stand corrected if any of your hearers know of such a source, please communicate this with Station KFUO in St. Louis and forward it on to me. But I've never found that, and I think that's terribly significant.
A couple of the things on the Resurrection Day itself, two other locations that figure prominently are the Upper Room, presumably in Jerusalem, where the disciples, or I'm assuming it's the Upper Room, where the disciples flee after the crucifixion of Christ and hide out, and the town of Emmaus. Tell us about the Upper Room. Is this the same place where Christ celebrated the Passover and the Lord's Supper with his disciples?
We do think it was, because the same term is used, kataluma in Luke, the Upper Room, and we're still not exactly certain where this is. Now, to be sure, in today's Jerusalem, the guides will show you where the Upper Room is, but it's terribly unconvincing because there's two errors. First of all, it's still an upper room, and that's very unlikely because Jerusalem today is about 15 feet higher than it was in Jesus' day. The reason for that is the city was built and destroyed 13 times since Jesus' day, and each destruction leaves a rubble layer and so on. If the upper room were, say, on ground level today, then I might believe it. The other problem is, in the upper room that they show tourists today, there are Gothic arches, and the Gothic arch will not be invented for 11 centuries yet. So on a scale of 1 to 10, it's a big fat 1.
And the so-called account of the road to Emmaus, give us some idea about the relationship of Jerusalem to Emmaus and that account that I think we find in Luke's Gospel.
Well, thanks for such an easy question, Todd. There are four different candidates for Emmaus. Probably the most familiar one would be the later Roman military station, which was stationed at Emmaus, as a matter of fact, which is about 7 or 8 miles northwest of Jerusalem. And there is a commemorative church there today.
Why are there multiple candidates for, say, Emmaus, a whole town, for heaven's sakes, the Upper Room, and I presume places like the Tomb and Golgotha?
Well, we really shouldn't have multiple locations for Golgotha because it was for 19 and a half, about 19 centuries, the church knew exactly where it was. But you can attribute this to General Chinese Gordon, the fellow who will later die at Khartoum. He was a fervent Christian. And one evening he was dining on a rooftop terrace over Jerusalem, and he looked to the right near the Damascus Gate, and he said, look, there's a skull-shaped hill. And for no other reason than that, plus, there's also a verse in the Old Testament that the sacrifice must take place to the north of the temple. And on that slender basis, he simply identified this as Calvary. So it is, to be sure, a lovely place today. If you want to go there and meditate, this is a very nice place to do it. I mean, it's not nearly as busy as the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. But in terms of true location, forget it.
One other account that comes from the evening of Easter is the one regarding Thomas. And it carries on into the next week, where the disciples are again gathered in exactly the same place and Jesus appears again. Your thoughts on the whole Thomas story, so-called Doubting Thomas?
Well, I love it. As a matter of course, I'm a strange person anyway, but Thomas is my favorite apostle. I'll tell you why. Because this fellow's modern. He's a scientist. He's asking questions that so many people ask today. Is there evidence outside the scriptures to demonstrate this that will correlate with the biblical account? Maybe he's a little bit too much from Missouri, you know, show me state. Unless I touch his wounds and so forth, I will not believe. He probably overdoes it somewhat. But he is asking those terribly important questions that people ask to the present day yet. And I think one of the most beautiful proofs of the resurrection is that Jesus comes right through with Thomas's own formula. And pointing out that this is not simply a weird dream here. This really happened. This is tangible. And Thomas, you notice, doesn't even have to touch Jesus at that point. He simply falls on his knees and says, my Lord and my God.
With only about 2 minutes, what does it say to you that these men who were witnesses, eyewitnesses of the resurrected Christ, almost seem to change overnight? After the day of Pentecost, they go from hiding in upper rooms to being bold, standing in the temple courts, being tossed in jail, going hither and yon with the message of Christ raised from the dead.
Well, everybody changes. You notice the next brother down from Jesus, James, James the Just of Jerusalem, he did not believe in Jesus during his public ministry. He didn't even believe in him on Good Friday, but he believes after Easter Sunday. simply because this blew his mind. Here his brother was very dead and very much alive later on. And this is just a typical example of what happened to all the apostles. They were changed people. That would happen to us, too, if we saw it with our own eyes. This is why later on they'll brave anything, imprisonment, torture, death, no problem. If this had been invented, like so many biblical critics claim, you know, this was Peter's great pipe dream, a way of trying to salvage the Enterprise after they had totally hitched their wagon to the wrong star, you know, supposedly gets the disciples together and says, what do you want to do, fellas? We wasted 3.5 years of our lives. What do you want to do, go back to fishing? And suddenly his face brightens and he says, hey, I got an idea. Follow my plan, someday they'll name churches after us. You know, something like that. Well, that's ridiculous because I'll tell you when the whole thing would have blown. Wide open would be when Peter's ready to be hoisted on a cross at a Roman arena. At that point, he'd have blown a shrill whistle. Time out, you know. Turn state's evidence here. We'll tell you how he did it if I come off with my life. You would never give your life for your own fairy tale.
Dr. Paul Meyer, thank you very much for being our guest again on Issues, Etc.
Good to talk to you, Todd. Blessed Easter and blessed post-Easter.
And to you as well. Dr. Paul Meyer is professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo. He's author of several books, including In the Fullness of Time and our Issues, Etc. book of the month for April called The Very First Easter. Now, you can purchase both of these books at Concordia Publishing House, their bookstore, located at 3558 South Jefferson here in St. Louis. That's 3558 South Jefferson in St. Louis. Or you can also purchase both of these books, In the Fullness of Time and The Very First Easter, at the bookstore on the campus of Concordia Seminary here in Clayton. You can get The Very First Easter also by calling Concordia Publishing House at 1-800-325-3040. That's 1-800-325-3040. Ask for the Issues, Etc. book of the month for April, The Very First Easter, 1-800-325-3040. Now, the cost of the book is $12.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040, or you can also order the book online. Go to our Issues, Etc. website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you're going to find information on The Very First Easter by Dr. Paul Meyer. When we come back from this break, we're going to spend the remaining hour of Issues, Etc. talking with Dr. Kim Riddlebarger, part two of our four-part series on understanding the end times. Last time we talked with Dr. Riddlebarger, we defined terms. What is dispensationalism? What is amillennialism? What is the real millennium? And this time we're going to talk about the roots of end times teaching in the Old Testament and how to understand that all of the Bible has an eschatological or an end times outlook. That's coming up after this break with Dr. Kim Riddlebarger. Stay tuned.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.